funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why did Lisbon become such a vital and important city during the Second World War, even as Portugal remained steadfastly neutral throughout? The country's refusal to officially take sides made Lisbon both a haven for war refugees and an open center of operations for both Axis and Allied powers. Celebrities, diplomats, and spies on either side could pass one another on the street or dine in the same cafes, even as German and Allied planes parked side by side at the city's airport. All that international contact also made Lisbon an ideal site for espionage, deal-making, and financial opportunism, which in turn make it a great subject for a history book like the one my guest Neil Lockery has just published. He's a scholar based at University College London, and the book is called Lisbon, War in the Shadows of the City of Light, 1939 to 1945. Neil, welcome to Think.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having me on your show, Chris.
So people likely remember that Victor and Ilsa escaped to Lisbon at the end of the film Casablanca, but people who knew both the city and the film during the war actually called Lisbon Casablanca too. What did they have in common?
Well, I think they had quite a lot in common. They had an enormous amount of refugees who were desperately trying to escape Europe to go to either the United States or to Palestine. They had the idea of selling gems, diamonds, etc. And there was a sort of seediness, I think, to both Lisbon and Casablanca, which comes over in the film Casablanca quite well. But in many ways, I have to say that Lisbon was really the real Casablanca. It mirrored the film very much more than Casablanca did in reality.
Why was it so vitally important to Portugal's prime minister that his country remain neutral during this war?
Well, it was vital, first of all, I think, because he believed that the Portuguese military could not defend Portugal from an attack by the Germans. Therefore, he tried to become neutral in order to prevent a German attack. And on top of that, the ancient ally of Portugal, which is Great Britain, decided not to arm Portugal and also refused to give a guarantee that it would be able to protect Portugal in the war.
And this despite the fact that their treaty literally dates back to the 14th century.
It was Britain's and still is Britain's oldest treaty.
Salazar, the Prime Minister, Antonio de Oliveira Salazar, had grave concerns about maintaining Portugal's colonial holdings. Talk about the territory that beyond its own borders that was under Portuguese control at the time of the war.
Well, there was significant territory in Africa and in Angola and in what became Mozambique, particularly Angola, very rich in diamonds and various other things which Portugal traded with. I mean, the Portuguese economy was very weak and it was hugely dependent upon trade with its colonies and also its ex-colonies as well, such as Brazil.
And Salazar is perhaps the most fascinating character in this story that I have to say is chock full of them. Can you talk about, I called him the prime minister, but in fact he was a dictator and prime minister. Talk about the kind of government he ran and what that meant for regular people in Portugal.
Well, he's a fascinating character. He originally was a scholar at Coimbra University, which is probably the most prestigious university in Portugal. He then went on to become minister. He was a scholar in accountancy and finance. He then went on to become minister of finance at a technocrat appointment at the end of the 20s to basically try to get Portugal out of the economic hole that it was in. And then from that he became appointed. He was appointed prime minister in 1932. And he ran Portugal for pretty much 40 years, which, when you think about it, is an incredibly long time for any one leader to rule over a country. As a character, he's full of very, very different factors. He comes from a very small village in the north of Portugal. He was very much an outsider to Lisbon and to Portuguese society. He is someone who has had a very peculiar worldview in that he foresaw a lot of the events that were going to come after the end of the Second World War, such as the Cold War. He was a very strong Catholic, extraordinarily anti-communist, and indeed his whole career was based very much on the notion that the communists were the major threat to the world rather than the Nazis. He was something of an Anglophile, I would suggest, culturally, although in terms of politics, he was willing to do business with anybody, and as you know, he did do business with anybody.
I mean, did his concern about communism give him a natural affinity for someone like Adolf Hitler?
I don't think he really did have an affinity for Hitler. He regarded a lot of the kind of complexities of the Third Reich as nothing to do with Portugal at all. From all the documents I read, and I spent 6 months in the archives in Lisbon and a similar amount of time in London and in America, I couldn't find any documents in which he illustrated or showed any kind of interest really in Hitler's racial policy or in Hitler the sort of personality cult at all. He seemed very sort of, if I can use the word, neutral about Hitler.
What sort of place was Lisbon specifically in Portugal before the war broke out in 1939?
It was a really quiet backwater. Things hadn't been going very well for Portugal. It hadn't really recovered from the Great Depression very well. Its hotels were very quiet. It was off the beaten track. There was no international airport in Lisbon, for example. And it was a type of place where some Europeans went because of the quiet, because of the relatively mild winters, but really right off the beaten track, and it was a real backwater of Europe.
Of course, things began to change very rapidly as refugees realized if they could get to Lisbon, they could buy safe passage to the Americas, for example.
Absolutely. As soon as World War II broke out, Lisbon became very strategically important. It became important for the naval wars. It became important in terms of, as you said, for a route of escape for refugees. And particularly after the fall of France in the summer of 1940, which led to a huge number of refugees fleeing France, trying to get visas, transit visas to get through Spain, then through Portugal, and then get a passage on the boat to America or Palestine, or for the very rich, on the Clipper, which flew directly from Pan Am Clipper, which flew directly from Lisbon to New York.
How difficult was it to get a visa to go to Portugal?
Oh, really difficult. Mm-hmm. And Salazar made it clear that the visas that he would issue would be transit visas. Nobody would be allowed to stay in Portugal. And the problem was that you have to think about trying to marry up all these different administrative problems, because you had to get a visa to get through Spain, you had to get a separate visa to get through Portugal, and the dates on the visas were very restricted. It wasn't an open visa that you could remain in Portugal for 3 months. Most of the visas were for 30 days, 60 days. And I've got to say that there's a huge number of really sad cases where children who were fleeing the Holocaust, Jewish children, were simply their visas and the passages on the ships didn't work out, and they effectively were in Lisbon and basically got sent back to Spain.
Hmm. Now, there were people who defied Salazar's orders and continued issuing visas to those that they thought they could help, not least of which was the consul general in Bordeaux, France.
Yes, this is a curious story which I spent a long time researching, and there are somewhat different versions on this. The Portuguese consul was a man called Aristides de Souza de Mendes, an interesting character. He had 13 children. He was a career diplomat. His brother had actually been Salazar's first foreign minister. And the story was that in Bordeaux that he eventually just started giving away visas to anybody who wanted to come through Portugal. There was a criteria set by Salazar, which was called Circular 13, in which they were not supposed to give visas to Jews. But this Aristides de Souza Mendes apparently did not carry out. And in a period in June 1940, he issued what we think something like a couple of thousand. Now, there is some dispute, obviously, about the number of visas for people to get out. And a number of Jewish refugees were able to escape thanks to his work. Now, the problems arise when there's been allegations by not least the British and the British ambassador in Lisbon that he was receiving money in order to issue some of these visas. And the evidence on this, I have to say, is a little unclear. In the book, I try and make the best case possible to suggest that it could be either way. I mean, we don't really have a definitive answer to it. But he was a fascinating character.
I have to tell you, we mentioned that there are many fascinating characters. Nobody here is entirely comes through unscathed in terms of having some character flaws.
Absolutely. This is I think one of the things I try to get over in the book is that nobody really is quite as they seem. Just as you try to characterize something or characterize a person, then something else happens, and you realize that they really, like you say, nobody gets out of this looking particularly fantastic.
Why did Salazar resist giving visas to Jews? Was he simply an anti-Semite, or was he worried about complications that their presence would create?
Do you know what? It's a really good question, and I spent a long time looking at this, and I couldn't find any evidence to suggest that he was an anti-Semite at all. For Salazar, everything was about playing the political game, and what he feared was that if he antagonized the Germans by effectively allowing Jewish refugees to be openly able to get out through Lisbon, that this could possibly lead to the Germans taking action against Portugal, perhaps bombing Portugal. The German Air Force after 1940 was within reach of Portugal's northern cities, or perhaps invading Portugal, or even encouraging Spain and General Franco to launch a proxy invasion.
Now, one thing that Portugal did have going for it, even when it was a somewhat backwater country, is a really good supply of wolfram, which in this country we call tungsten. Can you talk about what was so important about tungsten during the war?
Tungsten was absolutely vital to the German war machine. It is a rare ore which was mined in Portugal, which is used to harden steel. Its use in the military industries is widespread. It can be used to make tank shells. It can be used to make airplanes. It can be made to use triggers on guns. Without tungsten, the German armaments industry would have ground to a halt. And after the Germans launched their attack on the Soviet Union, they were almost totally dependent upon Portugal for the supply of this tungsten. If Portugal had stopped supplying the tungsten to the German war armaments machine would have ground to a halt.
Of course, the concern from Salazar was he could either sell it to the Nazis or they could come in and take it.
Yes, I mean, he says, you know, in defending himself, he says, if I don't sell it to the Germans, they'll just simply come and get it. I mean, it really was of such importance. And the Allies knew it was of great importance as well, and they tried to buy the Portuguese wolfram as well, tungsten. So you have this situation where Portugal's in a win-win game, where they're selling both to the Germans and to the Allies. The Allies didn't need it. They had other forms of supply, but they were just buying it to try and stop the Germans getting it.
My guest is Neil Lockery. He's a scholar based at University College London and author of the new book Lisbon, War in the Shadows of the City of Light, 1939 to 1945. We'll resume the conversation in a moment, and we have phone lines open now if you'd like to join us. The telephone number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Neil Lockery. He's a scholar based at University College London and author of the new book Lisbon, War in the Shadows of the City of Light, 1939 to 1945. Join our conversation by calling in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Neil, I gather another goal that Salazar had for Portugal during the war was to make some money. And one advantage of dealing with the Germans is that they were willing to pay as he required in gold.
Yes, that's absolutely correct. Initially, the Germans tried to pay for the wolfram they were buying from Portugal by using forged currency notes. These were escudo notes, which were printed on presses, which they'd captured in Holland. But after about a year or so, the Bank of Portugal woke up to this fact and decided that these were forgeries, and they went to Salazar and told him so. And so Salazar requested to the Germans that, in effect, that they pay for the tungsten in gold. This wasn't an unusual situation. In times of war, payment in gold is the safest form of payment, and Salazar requested it as a way of trying to ensure that the payment that Portugal were getting from the Germans was actually genuine.
But he himself lived a pretty austere lifestyle, is that right?
He did, this is an interesting one. That when he died in 1970, the state discovered that he didn't really have any money at all, and when he became ill, he had a stroke in 1968, and he didn't really even have the money to pay the medical bills. I mean, this wasn't a man who died with great riches. He came from a very poor family in Santa Combadão in Portugal. He lived a very frugal life. He didn't seem to have any interest in material possessions, and he didn't have a family either. So he was very much like a monk.
We have an email here from Steve in Dallas who wants to know, did either the Axis or the Allies attempt to urge or provoke Portugal into the war?
Both were quite happy at the start for Portugal to sit out the war. And as it went through, there were two major issues which could have possibly led to the Allies or the Axis powers provoking Portugal. One was the wolfram, the tungsten, sorry, if Portugal had refused to supply the Germans. The second one was over the Azores Islands. The Azores were absolutely vital to the Allies. The Azores are in the Atlantic, the Portuguese Atlantic Islands. And they were very important to the submarine warfare and in keeping the convoys coming from the South Atlantic, from America to Europe. And effectively, the Americans and the British wanted to have access to the Azores, to have their planes there and to have their ships there. If Salazar had said no to that, then I think the Americans had plans to invade the Azores and take them anyway.
And the Americans and the British sort of tag-teamed it to convince Salazar to give them access to the Azores.
Well, yes and no. I mean, there was a degree of that, but there were differences between the Americans and the British as well. I mean, and this goes to, I think, key differences between the Allies, which were right across all the different theaters in the European war. I mean, superficially, it all looks very homely between the Brits and the Americans over the Azores. But when you look at a little closer, there were differences, I think, in terms of the British believed that the Americans shouldn't make such demands, that the Americans shouldn't threaten the Portuguese with invasion, and the British were very much more into calm diplomacy.
How, to what extent was Salazar trying to sort of guess what the score would be at the end of the war and figure out how that would affect his ability to hang on to the colonial assets that Portugal had?
I think that's a really good question, and he read the war and very carefully, and I think his actions all the way through were very calculating. And when you look at him, you can pretty much divide Portuguese policy into two distinct time phases. One up until 1942, when he believed it was possible for a total German victory. mm-hmm. which he was more sympathetic towards the Germans, looking at how that would look in the post-war. From 42 onwards, it was really, he read the war as either being a German conditional surrender, which was his favorite outcome, or a total Allied victory, which was not his favorite outcome. And in reading the war, he, of course, positioned Portugal accordingly. I think the key thing to say is that he didn't stop selling wolfram to the Germans until the eve of D-Day in June 1944.
And he actually thought if the Allies took the war and there was an unconditional surrender by Germany and the Axis powers, that the U.S. might come in and try to dominate everything in Europe.
Yes, he was... He seemed to have something, some bee in his bonnet about the Americans. He described them as a godless people, governed by electric light and not God. He certainly had some issues with the Americans, and he seemed to fear, I think, a cultural, political, and economic domination of Europe by the Americans. He was offered aid at the end of the war as part of the Marshall Plan, but refused it.
Let's talk a little bit about the social climate in Lisbon during the war. What a fascinating place this must have been when you have Axis and Allied diplomats and you have secret agents and they're all sort of living side by side. What sort of day-to-day contact did these people have with one another?
Wow, they had enormous contact. Lisbon is actually quite a small city, and the hotels out along the coast towards Estoril and Cascais, there were two or three major international hotels where literally you would be, if you went down to breakfast, you would see on one table Gestapo agents, on the table next to them Jewish refugees. You would see famous kings and queens. The Duke and Duchess of Windsor were in Lisbon for some time in the summer of 1940.
We'll definitely talk more about them. They're fascinating.
They're absolutely fascinating. And I mean, the diplomats would be facing each other. They would sometimes, for example, the British ambassador would sometimes have to attend a dinner at which the German ambassador was also there as well.
And was there a sort of gentleman's agreement that everybody would behave themselves when they were in
No.
the city?
No, absolutely not. I mean, I think there was an agreement to drink as much as possible, mm-hmm. To enjoy themselves. The spying activities on each other were very serious, but also quite amateurish when you sort of look back on it. I mean, there were several instances of complete mess-ups on both sides.
And including one spy who wasn't even in Lisbon, despite the reports that he was sending back.
Yes, Garbo, I think we're referring to. Yes, mm-hmm. he was a fascinating character who was actually became one of the most significant agents for the British. He is, as far as I know, the only double agent to have actually been decorated by both the Germans and the British. He was awarded an Iron Cross by Adolf Hitler, and he was also awarded a CBE by Winston Churchill.
Did those Nazi operatives in the city pose any threat to Jewish refugees who were there?
Not really. I think we're talking more about intimidation rather mm-hmm. than anything sort of more than that. There were one or two instances, one particular famous case, which was of the Jewish pacifist Berthold Jacob, who was arrested on the streets by the Portuguese secret police working with the Gestapo, sent back to Spain and then subsequently to a concentration camp in Germany where he perished. That was an example which went against the grain. I think most of the German Gestapo agents in the city were very much under the control of the Portuguese secret police.
So among the British spies working in Lisbon was Ian Fleming, that of course we know as the man who wrote the James Bond series. What sort of work was he doing there?
He was in Lisbon on two occasions in the war, and he stayed in the very wonderful Palacio Hotel, which is where all the spies stayed. He was busy devising Operation Goldeneye, which James Bond fans will know actually became a film later. Mm-hmm. This was a plan to what to do about the fall of Gibraltar and Spain, etc. And he was here in Lisbon dealing with the embassy, trying to work out the Portuguese aspect of the operation. He was also gambling at the Palacio Hotel and the Estoril Casino. And some of the scenes which he describes in the book and in the film, they're in the film Casino Royale, are inspired by his time at the tables in Estoril.
I mean, the flow of money through this city must have been something to see.
It was. And in terms of looking at the documents, when I was writing the book, I wonder how much wasn't documented. I wonder how much of this was just coming in and out. Even the money which was documented, we're talking about huge amounts of money coming in and out of Portugal during the war.
Well, and especially when you talk about refugees coming in and having to pay for what they needed with, you know, the family, quite literally, the family jewels.
Absolutely. And bear in mind, this was the end of the line. You know, many of these refugees started out, you know, quite wealthy, middle-class refugees. But by the time they got to Lisbon, in having to buy all the relevant paperwork, having to bribe officials in France and Spain, many of them were completely broke, and they were selling the family silverware, literally diamonds, everything. And the price of diamonds in Lisbon was very, very low during the war.
There is a notable exception that we'll talk about in a moment in terms of a plane crash. But essentially, once if people could get to Lisbon and could book themselves on a flight or a boat headed west, they were left alone.
Yes, they were closely watched by the Portuguese secret police, particularly the Jewish refugees. Not so much because the Portuguese secret police were anti-Semitic, although one or two of them were. There was a fear that among this group there would be communists, and that was Salazar's total paranoia. And so they were closely watched, but they were largely left alone by the secret police.
So tell us the story of the actor Leslie Hauer that people may remember best as Ashley Wilkes in Gone with the Wind, but he, of course, was a very big star in his day. He died on a flight leaving Lisbon.
Yes, he did, rather tragically. He'd come to Lisbon on a BOAC flight to do basically a propaganda tour for the British Council. He went to Madrid, and he gave performances also in Lisbon. This was something that he'd done on previous occasions. And unfortunately, as his plane left Lisbon, it was shot down by the Germans over the Bay of Biscay. Now, the key to the story is there are different versions as to why his plane was shot down.
This was a commercial airliner.
Yes, it was a commercial airliner, but it was shot down by the Germans operating out of Bordeaux.
So give us the theories here.
Well, the theory that was put forward by Winston Churchill himself was that Leslie Howard resembled Winston Churchill's bodyguard. And Leslie Howard's agent, who was a man called Arthur Chenholz, resembled Winston Churchill. And that this was a case of mistaking identity. At the time, Churchill was in Casablanca meeting with President Roosevelt. And the idea was that the Germans had mistaken Leslie Howard and Chenholz for Churchill, and that's why the plane was targeted. It all sounds very nice, but it would be very unusual for Churchill to have taken such a route and to travel on what was effectively a commercial airliner on his way back from Casablanca. Mm-hmm. Another theory was that the British knew the plane had been painted by a German agent at Lisbon Airport, and that effectively they let the plane go because they'd intercepted it using the Ultra decoding device, and they didn't want the Germans to know that they had this device. So there are a number of theories. Another theory I put forward in the book is simply pilot error as well. When these planes had been attacked before, and the standard operating procedure was for them to dive into the clouds, but for some reason the Dutch pilot in BOAC flight 777 didn't do this. He just remained at the same altitude, and basically they were very easy to shoot down.
Mm-hmm. That's not a sexy theory, but perhaps it makes the most sense given everything else that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I think Churchill's theory, which he writes actually in his memoirs on World War II, it it all sounds interesting, but to me it's a little far-fetched.
Mm-hmm. And of course, there were also a lot of royals living in Lisbon, at least occasionally during this time, including the Duke and Duchess of Windsor.
Yes, interesting couple. very high opinion of themselves. They came to Lisbon through Madrid. They were living in the south, living in Paris, and then they fled the German invasion to the south of France. Then they were basically moved through Spain into Barcelona, Madrid, and ended up in Lisbon. And the idea was originally that they would return to England. The Duke and the Duchess were none too keen, as you can probably imagine, for this to happen, and he was looking for a job. Now, there are various series of plots of which went on here, and the major plot was a plot which the Germans called Operation Willy, and which is known basically as a means to try and get the king, or the ex-king, the Duke, to basically agree to go to Spain. And when the Germans invaded, as they'd hoped to, invade Britain, the king would go back on the throne as a sort of puppet German monarch. Now, there was a lot of evidence to suggest that there was a lot of things going on in Lisbon, not least the Spanish ambassador was a man called Nicholas Franco, who was the brother of General Franco, the dictator leader of Spain. And there was all sorts of various plots going on as to whether the Germans would try and persuade him, or whether they would try and kidnap him and take him back to Spain, where they would try and put the case to him in even stronger terms there. They wined and dined in Lisbon with the sort of high society people, bankers, leading industrialists, and it was a very sort of, we still don't really know the whole truth about this plot, because a lot of the documents are still not available to us in archives.
Neil Lockery is with us. He's a scholar based at University College London and author of the new book Lisbon, War in the Shadows of the City of Light, 1939 to 1945. If you'd like to join the conversation, or if you have a question about any of what we've been discussing, give us a call. The number is 1-800-933-5372, or you can also send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think is made possible by SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. Learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is scholar Neil Lockery. He's based at University College London and is the author of the new book Lisbon, War in the Shadows of the City of Light, 1939 to 1945. If you want to be part of the conversation, call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Perhaps not surprisingly for a boom town, there was a lot of prostitution in Lisbon. Of course, this has got to be a complicated thing when you have lots of people with secrets to tell.
Yes, and this was something which the Germans picked up on very quickly, very early on in the war. And the Germans effectively started to run a brothel racket in which they tried to use the prostitutes to get information from British sailors who were coming into Lisbon as to where the convoys were going to be, how big they were going to be, how many ships, etc., the tonnage. And this worked well for a while until the British uncovered it, and then basically they banned the sailors from going there, but also the British started offering the prostitutes more money as well.
Loose lips sink ships, literally.
Yes, it really. Yes.
What did, by the way, going back to the issue of the Windsors, what did Winston Churchill want them to do when they were hanging around having the time of their lives partying in Lisbon?
He was getting more and more irate with them. I mean, it's even in the documents which have been released, you can see Churchill's temper was being severely tested. Bear in mind the context. When the Windsors were in Lisbon, Britain was evacuating the beaches at Dunkirk. was just pulling back. He was trying to work out what to do. And then he was faced with this situation, which was basically a diplomatic minefield. And it was clear that the Windsors did not want to return to the UK. He was looking for a job to represent Britain. And Churchill, in the end, was just getting very, very irate with them.
It's sort of shameless to think of them as abandoning their own people at this time.
Yes, it is. And there's a film which is coming out in the UK. I think it's probably already out in America, made by Madonna, which emphasizes the love story side of it. I can tell you there wasn't much love lost between the royals on the throne and the ex-royals in Lisbon.
How did Peggy Guggenheim and Max Ernst end up in Lisbon?
They were on the run. They were on the run from the Nazis, trying to escape. They were helped by a Jewish rescue fund, which was funded by wealthy American Jews, including Solomon Guggenheim. And they were helped by a man called Varian Fry, who's a fascinating American character, a very brave man, who was basically running an escape line out of France through Spain into Portugal. When you look at the work, and if you read the book, you'll see some of the work he did was really quite remarkable. And he was basically given a list of Jewish prominent Jewish artists, public figures, with the job of getting them out. And Peggy was taken out down the line. She was very much she thought she was very much in danger from the Germans because of her sort of type of art that she liked. She was with, actually, Max Ernst, and also around about the same time, Marc Chagall, the other artist, another artist, came through Lisbon as well. They stayed in Lisbon. She was a very interesting character because most of the refugees, when they were in Lisbon, were very insular. They were just looking to get out. But Peggy made a lot of very interesting observations in Lisbon, and she had a very good time there as well, even though she was under a lot of strain. She made sure she had a good time, and she was quite astute, I think, in her assessment of Portugal at the time.
Was Portugal then as it is today, where people would have spoken multiple languages, or was there a language barrier?
No, there was definite language barriers. Most Portuguese, if they spoke a second language, spoke French. French was a major language. This didn't change until the mid-1980s, when French was dropped pretty much from the school curriculum to be replaced by English. And if you go to Lisbon today, you'll be probably amazed by the level of English that people speak there. It's very impressive. But no, certainly in the war, there were language barriers. Many Portuguese families spoke German as well. And I think German and French were probably the two most in use languages. Some of the Portuguese families who were related to English families obviously spoke English as well.
Who was making their fortunes during this time and sort of ended the war in Lisbon in a much better position than they had started it?
Portuguese banks clearly did extraordinarily well. Trading with Salazar's blessing, and they were quite open about it. When Salazar told them to stop trading with the Germans, they stopped. But they did very well. Individuals, private individuals dealing in smuggling, did very well. Initially, the Portuguese villagers, peasants living up by the wolfram mines, it was basically like gold rush time. Mm. I mean, they made fortunes, absolute fortunes. Many of them actually lost a fortune, of course, as well, because they had no education. Salazar nationalized the mines eventually, and the state took all the profits. But in the first year, 18 months of the war, these people who were living in very backward villages were suddenly coming into enormous fortunes.
Of course, it's reasonable to ask about the amount of profit that Portugal made with Nazi gold.
The Nazi gold story is, I think, one of the most interesting parts of the whole story, and it's still related to events in the present. Portugal was paid in Nazi gold, but by 1942-43, it was clear that much of this gold wasn't legitimate. It was coming from, first of all, the central banks of the countries that the German army had occupied, mm-hmm. Belgium, Holland, etc. And then it became apparent that this was coming from the victims of the Holocaust, be it gold stolen directly from their possession or things like melted down gold teeth.
Mm-hmm.
And the Allies believed that much of this gold was ill-gotten gain. And after the war, they made attempts to try and get Portugal to pay back the gold, just as they did with other neutral countries. Salazar refused, and there was a series of very complicated negotiations which went on. But the key to understanding all this is the Americans in the new era of the Cold War after World War II wanted to keep the Azores bases.
Mm-hmm.
And so basically the State Department very quietly traded that for allowing the Portuguese to keep about 95% of the gold. We don't know really how much the gold, and all the documents, the American and British documents, put the figure conservatively at about 400 tons. Personally, I think it's a lot more. 400 tons of gold at today's value is worth something like $20 billion. So this is a lot of money. And Salazar didn't spend the gold. He kept it. He kept it for a rainy day, which never came. And the gold has been, as far as we know, it's stashed around in various accounts. Some of it went to Macau. Some of it seemed to have gone to Canada. Some of it, I'm sure, is in America. Some of it's in Switzerland. A small part is still in Lisbon. Apparently, the Bank of Portugal still has gold bars with swastikas on it, according to some of its employees.
Hmm.
Now, this was raised earlier this year when the Germans brought it up. Funnily enough, when Portugal was asking for a bailout from the EU, a 78 billion euro bailout, the Germans were suggesting that perhaps Portugal should sell some of its family silverware, which was clearly code for selling some of its gold, before it was given the bailout. And so this story goes on, and it's met by stony silence in Lisbon.
Is there any ongoing litigation from the survivors and families of survivors of the Holocaust trying to recover any of this wealth?
There has been, but because Portugal settled officially, then I'm not sure what the exact legal status is. As far as I'm aware at the moment, is that there is nothing formally going on.
What was the primary function of Salazar's secret police force, and how much of a threat were they to regular Portuguese citizens?
The police force was effectively to keep everyone in check and to prevent communists and opposition figures from taking over. They were pretty nasty in the Second World War. If you antagonized them, and even some foreign journalists found this to their cost as well. The London Times correspondent who dared criticize Salazar was unceremoniously kicked out of the country by the secret police after being given a somewhat hostile questioning session. But for most Portuguese, they were very passive at this time, and their contact with the secret police would have been much less than, say, the communists.
Salazar, of course, hung on for 20-plus years after the end of the war. For better or worse, does he deserve credit for shielding his people from the worst of World War II?
I think that's a really good question, and it's a difficult question to answer. In the book, I try and make both cases, and I try and suggest that he probably did very well from a Portuguese perspective. But if I wasn't Portuguese, I'm not sure how impressed I would be by him.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think it's a case of balancing the arguments either way. I personally think that he did very well for the country, but at what price?
Why do you think that Salazar's name is not sort of up there in the household words list of long-lived European dictators?
That's a good question, and I think perhaps it's because what happened after the Second World War, as soon as the war ended, effectively Portugal went back to becoming pretty much a backwater again.
Mm-hmm.
This period of World War II was a very unique period in which suddenly this city and this country found itself at the center of events. And then once the war ended, sort of normality returned, and there wasn't a great influx of tourism as Salazar, I think, had hoped to happen. And then Portugal started getting very insular again and didn't have much contact with the outside world, really, mm-hmm. until the revolution in Portugal, which brought in democracy in 1974.
And little by little, over the time preceding that, Portugal lost its colonial holdings.
Portugal tried to hold on for as long as possible, and when the revolution came and democracy came, it coincided with decolonization. It's a very unusual situation where you have democracy and decolonization at exactly the same moment in history, and that caused a lot of complications to Portugal, and it lost its major, you know, its major colonial possession, which I would probably suggest would be Angola, with its diamonds, its oil, its great resources.
You mentioned that you spent time in Lisbon and in Portugal doing research for this book. Can you talk a little bit about how the city of today compares, even physically, with the city that you describe in the book?
The center of Lisbon hasn't changed very much at all. Hmm. You could be walking through a movie set from World War II. It really hasn't changed much at all. And it's used for filming. It's incredibly photogenic. And it really does resemble, I mean, the photographs in the book, if you went and took the photographs from some of the places that we have included in the book, you would see how remarkably similar Lisbon today is as it was in World War II.
And what is the feel of the city culturally?
Culturally, Lisbon is now very much a young person's city. The center of Lisbon is one of the hubs of European nightlife. It has very liberal drug laws, which tend to attract people from all over Europe to go and party. For many years, Amsterdam had this kind of reputation, and now Portugal seems to be, certainly for young people, having that kind of reputation. It also has a very strong sort of weekend tourist scene as well, where lots of older people come from over Europe to spend a weekend in the place. And culturally, there is actually quite a lot happening, even though it doesn't have very much money.
That weekend tourism thing is fascinating to us in the States, because we can't imagine being able to go to Portugal for 3 days and be back at work on Monday.
Yes, I mean, but really, I think you can see Lisbon in 3 days, and it really is lots of... lots of people. It's a very European thing, I understand. Lots of people are doing it.
Neil Lockery, it's been a fascinating conversation. The book is really, really interesting. Thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you for having me on your show.
Neil Lockery is a scholar based at University College London. His new book is called Lisbon, War in the Shadows of the City of Light, 1939 to 1945. Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.